That's music from John Ann Gotti, his song Crucified. It's 15 minutes after the hour, a little later than usual. Dr. Don has been waiting patiently for us, and he joins us now from Garden Valley, Texas. Dr. Don, a member of the board at Creation Moments and our resident biochemist. Don, happy to have you. Happy Monday to you.
Well, good morning, and happy Monday to you, too.
Well, thank you. Now, here in the Lake Region of East Dakota, it's starting to feel like spring. We had a day in the 50s yesterday. We're surrounded by melting snow and tons of mud. So we know that the season is in transition here. How are things down in Garden Valley? Are the grapes budding yet in your vineyard?
Oh, they have budded, indeed. Ooh. And they're probably about 2 or 3 inches long now.
Whoa, really?
Okay. Yeah. Wow. So we have budded. We had a nice day of rain yesterday, and temperatures are in the 50s, so okay. We're not much warmer than you guys.
We're about the same. We'll be in the 50s later today. Dr. Don, in addition to his biochemistry stuff, now his vocation is running this vineyard, and we learn more about, in fact, Don, sometimes I think we learn more about grapes here than about anything else. That's interesting stuff.
I'm still very much learning.
Yeah, but you know, the fact that you're dabbling in grapes here dovetails so nicely with a lot of what we learned from Doug Greenwald and Old Testament of vineyards in the Holy Land and the significance of wine in the Bible. And it's like an alternate topic we have that's of consuming interest here, so to speak. We do learn about science versus faith and evolution versus creationism and young earth versus old earth. We have a great time discussing those with Dr. Don here. And just so you know, all of our past conversations are available to you on the website as podcasts. And you can look over the last couple of years, and there's a little couple of introductory sentences to each podcast that identifies the subject matter. And you can learn a whole lot by listening to what Don has to say. And today, something about a DNA clock. Now, you're going to have to explain that. What is a DNA clock?
Mm. Well, yes, it's going to take a little bit of an explanation. Of course, we know that if you've had any biology whatsoever, you know that DNA is the kind of the information storehouse in the cell. But in eukaryotic cells, that is, cells without an exterior membrane and cells with a nucleus, they have two different places where DNA is stored. And the first place is obviously in the nucleus of the cell, and the nucleus is responsible for protecting, as well as all the machinery is available in there for reproduction and for copying the DNA when the cell needs new proteins. So all of that takes place in the nucleus, but there is another organelle within the cell that's called mitochondria.
Mm, I've heard the term. Yeah.
If you remember from your biology, the mitochondria is often referred to as the powerhouse of the cell. And inside the mitochondria, the main purpose is to make a molecule, an energized molecule called adenosine triphosphate, or ATP. And then that molecule travels around the cell and provides the chemical energy needed to do most of the reactions, if not all the reactions, within the cell. So there, inside the mitochondria, though, is DNA, and the mitochondria DNA is, like I said, different from the nuclear DNA. The nuclear DNA, you have one set of DNA that comes from the father, and one set of DNA that comes from the mother. But the interesting thing about the mitochondrial DNA, you only get that from your mother.
Ah.
Because it's in the egg and it's not in the sperm.
There's a marvelous intricacy here. I mean, it's just it's like a little machines. Yeah.
Yeah. So what does that mean as far as the topic that we're talking about today?
Yeah, what do we care?
So if you're looking for changes within the DNA, let's say over generations, mm-hmm. And you're trying to eliminate individual variations that, for example, you get, you have variations that you get from your mother and you have your variations that you get from the father. Well, it would be easier to study those variations if you look at the mitochondrial DNA than it would if you look at the nuclear DNA.
Somewhat simpler? Because it's just the one?
Just doesn't have another confounding factor in that is the variation in the DNA that we see, for example, is that due to natural DNA variation due to different individuals, or is it due to actually mutation rates? Mm-hmm.
And now, these will be subtle changes between the generations. This is not going from frogs to dinosaurs to whales to chimpanzees to humans. This is within a kind, there are variations.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Gotcha. So, and we're trying to, with looking at the mitochondrial DNA, we're trying to eliminate the variations within the kind. And what we're looking for is the changes in the DNA that are strictly from mutations. Mm-hmm. Okay. So you get a cleaner set if you look at the mitochondrial DNA as opposed to the nuclear DNA. All right. So we've got that established. Mm-hmm. Now, back to the clock.
Yeah. Why are we looking at this anyway? Yeah.
So. If one knew the rate of mutation within the DNA, and our DNA is mutating all the time, mm-hmm. Putting it another way, our DNA is devolving all the time.
Dr. Don's theory of devolution, which we've covered here in past programs.
Well, then you want to look at the mitochondrial DNA because it's going to be less confounded by these other things I mentioned earlier. So this study that was done, and you can find it on the Institute of Creation Research website, is an interesting one because they took the published data on the mutation rate for different type of species. Humans was one of them, for example. They looked at, I think it was roundworms and fruit flies and water flies. Now, the reason why they chose those was that's the available data.
Gotcha. Okay.
With the mutation rate. So the mutation rate was measured independently by independent laboratories over, you know, periods of time. Mm-hmm. You can look at the DNA and you can say, well, okay, we know that X percent of the DNA has mutated over this period of time. Now, what can you do with that? Well, if you assume that this mutation rate has been constant, which is a favorite assumption of the evolutionists.
They make a lot of those assumptions, yeah.
If you assume it has been constant over eons of time, then there is a simple equation that you can look at what the change is or what the mutation percentage is or number is, for example, within a certain DNA. And knowing the rate, you can then figure out how much time has passed.
Since the first one?
Yeah,
okay,
exactly.
Gotcha. Okay. So you take an existing organism now, a fruit fly or a water fly or a roundworm or a human, and you kind of work backwards. You'd have to have some other benchmark in the past, though, wouldn't you? You'd have to be able to measure how much the DNA has changed. Or do you just assume that, like you said, it's a constant? So from wherever we are now, that constant should get you back to the original, the creation, the predecessor, the ancestor.
Right. And here's the thing. We know how much it's we know how much variation there is in the DNA right now. I mean, you can do laboratory experiments to figure out, okay, well, 10 DNA nucleotides have been changed in, for example, the human DNA mm-hmm. on an average.
Since when?
Well, that's just the number. We don't know since when.
Yeah, but you got to be, if you're looking at these nucleotides and you say they're changed, you have to have an original one someplace, don't you?
Well, yeah, look at a whole bunch of DNA, mitochondrial DNA from a lot of human species, a lot of us. Okay.
Gotcha.
And which is, you know, can be readily available. Mm-hmm. And then you just compare them. You do a DNA analysis on the mitochondrial. You isolate the mitochondria. You do a DNA analysis. And then you, there are programs, computer programs that will match up the DNA for the various individuals, and then you just go across and you say, how much variability is there in this DNA?
So it's kind of a measurement of the degree of variation within a species then at any given time.
Yes and no. That's what we're trying to eliminate.
Oh, okay.
Is the variation within the species, and trying to get to the actual mutations within the DNA, because that's what we're measuring.
Okay, I think I'm with you. Yeah.
Yeah, and okay. The notion of the clock, in essence, is you start out with the time, and you already know that you're going to measure the amount of time from Tuesday to Friday,
right?
For example, or 6 hours, or whatever. And so you measure those changes. You measure some at the beginning of the 6 hour period, and then the same ones at the end of the 6 hour period.
And then you can establish a rate. That's a rate, yeah.
Yeah, they give you a rate of change.
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
Right. If you know like I said, in previous experiments, others have measured the rate of mutation in DNA for various species, and they happen to have it, I mean, for these four species, which allowed, doing this paper, for example.
Mm-hmm.
We have a simple equation that says the mutation differences, or the differences in the DNA, is equal to 2 times the rate times the time. I mean, it's a very simple equation, mm-hmm. And I'm surprised it's so straightforward, but it is. And so, what this author did was, he said, "Well, let's assume that we've got from the Bible, if you believe a literal, pretty much a literal translation of the Bible, and the time frame that's listed in the Bible, we're looking at about 6,000 years." But let's round that up to 10,000 years. And we know from evolution, evolution theory, if you will, or evolution guess is how I like to say, mm-hmm. that, for example, for humans, they say that humans came about 180,000 years ago. So here's what we'll do. We'll plug in 180,000 years, multiply it by the known rate of mutation for this mitochondrial DNA, and we'll plug in 10,000 years and into the same formula, and we'll get the number of differences in both of those equations, and then we'll compare that to the actual differences that we observe.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so very straightforward. You do that. And of course, the evolutionary number gives you a DNA difference of between 124 to 290 DNA base pair differences. Creation 10,000 years gives you 7 to 16. And the observed differences in mitochondrial DNA is from 0 to 32, or an average of about 10.
Mm-hmm.
So you can look at this and you can say, well, which model fits the data better? And uh, the The range there is due to the range in the observed rate of
The 0 to 32 part of it. Yeah.
Right. So it's not obviously due to the time because we're holding the time constant. So you look at that and you say, well, there's a tremendous difference between the evolutionary model and the creation model. And guess what? The creation model fits the observed data very, very well. Mm-hmm. So that's for one species, which is the humans, which, of course, we're most interested in. But if it was only if it only worked for the human species, then we would say, well, yeah, okay, it's an interesting model, but
coincidence.
Coincidence. Mm-hmm. It's not very robust. So we'll take the other three data points that we know. Let's look at the fruit flies, and with the fruit fly, the fruit fly, for example. The differences in DNA based on the evolutionary model would be on the order of 100,000 to 2.3 million. And with the creation model, it's between 49 and 1,157, mm-hmm. and the observed DNA differences for the fruit fly is 1,168. So again, the creation model is much more accurate to the than the evolutionary model to the actual data. And you look at the roundworms, and the same thing. the evolutionary model is projecting upwards to 3.3 million base pair differences in DNA, whereas the actual data is 1,600, and you get a range between 1,000 to 1,700, 1,800 with the creation model for the roundworms.
So we're saying that by in measuring these variations, it is apparent that these variations were more likely to have occurred within a 6,000 year period than a much longer period. And this is using the evolutionary system. It's their formula, right?
Well, it's their time frame.
Mm-hmm.
So
that's, you know, that's the one
example,
unit of the formula.
They say water flies came about 7 million years ago. Mm-hmm. Well, if that was true, 7 million years ago, you should expect for water fleas, for example, that would lead to, based on the DNA mutation rate, that would lead to 120 to 160,000 DNA differences, mm-hmm. and the observed is 650.
Okay, so let me take this another way then. There's a very simple formula that both creationists and evolutionists can look at and say, yeah, there's validity in it. Those are the factors to use this. And if we plug in the evolutionary numbers, the evolutionists' numbers, and compare it with using the factor created by what the Bible tells us, about 6,000 year old Earth, they rounded it up 10,000. Just I don't know why, but okay. But that creationist model works in the formula when compared with observable data, those number of variations. The evolutionary model does not.
Right, and the put it a different way, the evolutionary time frame for when these organisms came about is so way off that you know, it doesn't even come close. Where at least the creation time frame, or let's say 10,000 years or less, is very much in the ballpark, and not in the ballpark. I mean, it covers the gamut of what you actually observe. Mm-hmm. So the actual DNA changes that have taken place are very highly suggesting that these organisms have not been around all that long. They've only been around a very short period of time, and short meaning, you know, mm-hmm. 10,000 years or less versus, of course, millions of years or hundreds of thousands of years in the case of the human. So this is, you know, very interesting data. You're not going to see this published in National Geographic, unfortunately, but because it obviously promotes a young Earth and a young young life model, which, of course, you know, us creationists promote all the time. So it's interesting data.
That's a great frustration to have something that, that sounds so so definitive that gets ignored by the mainstream.
Don.
Yeah.
Such a pessimist. Such a pessimist you are. You know, I like to wake up every morning and think, you know, this is the morning when all the mainstream media is going to say, they're going to wake up and they're going to look around and they're going to say, I know, let's just write stories that actually happened. Let's write news about things that are really going on as opposed to our conjecture. You know, then just slight digression here. I just read this great big long story about changes made to Obamacare over the weekend in a, you know, a voice vote only, and Republicans were supporting it. And it was minor changes to the deduction level in small businesses. And, you know, the story is trying to make it out to seem like the Republicans have caved on Obamacare. And I mean, the purpose of the story was to get votes as opposed to, you know, explain anything that actually happened. One of the things that, and you know, I was watching a documentary that I think it was 2011, 2012, and it was about the Texas State Board of Education and in their selection of school books or textbooks and in going through that process. And the movie, the documentary was called The Revisionaries. And, you know, when it started out, I thought The Revisionaries, and this is going to be interesting and it's going to be good. And I thought, well, this is about the people that are trying to revise the way truth is and to try to reimpose and strengthen and shore up the evolutionary theory and you know, and that sort of thing. And, you know, cast it in concrete. In fact, I even heard one of the people on the screen say evolution is actually closer to a law than it is a theory. And I said, no, I don't think so. I mean, not, you know, if it was a law, it would be in every headline around the world. And so the more I got into this particular documentary, The Revisionaries was the title of the group that's trying to supposedly, and you know, every time they were accused of putting creationism into public schools and textbooks, the people that were sitting on the board saying, no, we're just using the scientific theory and trying to present as much information as possible about all of these topics. I mean, we don't have a preconceived notion about what should be in there. We want all information presented and let individual students make up their minds based on the information, just like what you just said. Just look at the data. Just look at the information. You don't invent that. You don't make up your own stuff. You just look at the stuff that's there, and you make a conclusion.
And I was part every 10 years the textbooks are reviewed here in the state of Texas, and I was part of the biology textbook review, which was probably 5 or 6 years ago now, and. So I reviewed the available textbooks that the different publishers, you know, had and they were promoting. And I was just pointing out some very simple errors that some of the things that were in the textbooks had been discounted or proven erroneous like 50 years ago. And they're still in the textbooks.
Still there.
Yeah. And it's... you were each speaker that went before the school board, you know, in Texas, when they were having this review. You had 3 minutes to present whatever it is you wanted to present. So, I had 3 minutes. I had my paper written out, and I was giving my notes, And the school board was so interested in what I was saying, they're saying, this guy actually has some science behind him.
He actually knows what he's talking about.
As long as they ask questions, you have the podium. And so so I wound up having like 15 minutes of time with these folks, just pointing out the various errors that were in these textbooks.
Yeah. Do you remember how many of those things that were changed as a result of what you talked about?
Well, here's the problem. The law actually states in Texas that you must present all sides when you're talking about the origins. Anything dealing with origins, you must present all mm-hmm. sides.
Sure.
But we have this organization called the Teachers Association,
mm-hmm.
and so the board, unfortunately, defrays the final working out of the problems and the issues to this board, to this other organization. Now, this other organization is ultra liberal, and of course, mm-hmm. they only want the anything that supports their side. So. It's not an unbiased body as one would hope that it would be, and I'm not sure how much of the textbooks actually got changed, but some of the blatant errors I am hoping at least have gotten changed. But anyway, yeah, it's highly political, and even though the law states that you must promote information from both sides, it often doesn't get accomplished because of these other forces that are in place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the movie, the documentary, and it, you know, I even hesitate to call it a documentary, more of a propaganda piece. It just seemed like there wasn't any presentation in the film of what the stances were. And that was one of the most frustrating parts of it. I watched maybe the first 20 minutes, hoping that eventually they'd actually put on the screen what some of these people said.
Uh-huh.
I mean, there's an anthropologist, Bateman, I think is the guy's name, and he figured prominently in the whole thing, and he kept ranting and railing during his testimony and saying, this is not true, and that's not true, and this is false, and this is erroneous, and this is misleading, and I wanted to see what this was. Mm-hmm. And they never showed this. They never said, look, this is what these nutcases are suggesting, or this is what the absolute truth is. Here it is in black and white. And that was never demonstrated, never even talked about. Mm. They concentrated a lot more about getting McElroy off the chairmanship, and now I guess he was reelected in 2012, and then he was taken off the chairmanship. The movie made it look like it, you know, was finally the rest of the board saw that he was just an ideological creationist nutball that should be removed, and so they just moved him down at a regular position as opposed to the chairmanship, and that's I doubt
like it was
that,
more
that
about politics case. than yeah. the educational issue itself. So
and that's what this movie was. I mean, it was more about the politics of it all, and never, you know, in the 20 minutes that I saw, never talked about what is being suggested. What kind of heinous suggestion are you trying to put across on us? And it never was there.
Don, I have a tough question for you. How does the scientific world look at the Institute for Creation Research? I mean, does it have credibility?
Yeah, it's not a tough question. It's an easy question. It's they scoff at the at the organization, as you might expect, that they would say something on the order like, "Well, they don't really do science over there. This is all funny business," and they're just trying to promote propaganda. Now, you know, the one of the greatest tools of the enemy is to call truth lies and lies truth. And you get the same thing, you know, with this organization. But these folks do true, hard and fast science. I mean, they have independent laboratories do their analysis. They're not doing their analysis themselves. yes, they come to their own conclusion based on the understanding of what Scripture says, obviously. Mm-hmm. And but the venom that is spewed against some of this, well, a lot of this research is you know, is illogical. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just
there's an old saying that I just thought of, that it would state that ridicule is the first recourse of the scoundrel. Mm. I mean, if you don't have the facts to fight with, you choose other weapons. And this seems to be the weapon of first choice for institutional science, because there's so much vested in their current opinions, their credibility, their public standing, their professional prestige. And if there are holes shot in that, you know, it goes to the heart, and they're not about to allow that to happen. So rather than refute the facts, they'll disguise the facts or cloak the facts or ridicule the facts to the point where no one will take them seriously.
Right. Well, these folks have been around almost as long as Creation Moments, and they've been doing very good science since the beginning. Dr. Henry Morris, who started the organization, he died probably about 3 or 4 years ago or so. And but his sons are still running the organization. It's a well-respected creation organization. A lot of good science comes out of the organization. Their school it's in the Dallas area. You can get a graduate degree from the Institute of Creation Research, mm-hmm. in obviously creation science. Mm-hmm. They were actually out in Southern California in El Cajon, and they moved to the Dallas area number of years ago, and they were an accredited school in California, an accredited college or whatever in California, where you could actually get a creation, which is, you know, kind of weird, but you could. They were accredited somehow. Mm. They come to Texas, and they were having a whole lot of trouble getting accredited because of the rhetoric that, folks around them were saying. And I haven't followed it, but they may be accredited now. But it doesn't matter, you know, whether the state says you're accredited or not. They're still doing good science. You still can get a very good graduate degree, from the Institute. And anybody, you know, who is interested, young scientists who are interested in this, in any of these creation topics, this would be a good place to go and to not only learn more about it, but to be able to, from a intellectual scientific point of view, be able to argue your points very succinctly and very scientifically.
The Institute of Creation Research, by the way, we've been talking about the DNA clock today. That's where we started, and we'll have a link to that article in our podcast. So if you check back on our website at brokenroadradio.com, a little later today, you can see the podcast, and you can click on the link, or just go to Institute of Creation Research and search for an article on the DNA clock. I'm sure it'll pop up for you quite easily. Interesting to know, though, and really it's got to be comforting, to especially to young Earth creationists, to know that science is on their side, that there is valid science to support it. And I think sometimes the critics of that position, all they hear is Scripture and Bible and religious statements to support it, and they really aren't aware that there's science behind it. And that's the voice we need to amplify, I think.
Have you ever heard, Don, one of these scientific types, be critical of the DNA clock, or is it the information too new?
Let me see. I haven't seen any criticism of it, but I'm sure there will be.
Well, it would be good to be fun to follow up and see what direction they take, whether they actually deal with the science, with the formula, or if they continue to fall back on ridicule for the position. Dr. Don Clark, biochemist, and again, a member of the board of Creation Moments. Creation Moments, great place to spend some time. If you get to travel around the web a little bit, you can link to the creationmoments.com page from from our website at Broken Road Radio. Single click will get you there. You'll find they're a wonderful resource. All kinds of materials on the creationist position, including scientific and scriptural references. So it's a great resource for you. Don, as always, we're grateful that you stopped by today. Don joins us just about every Monday morning, and we get enlightened, and that's a good thing. Don, have a good week. And may your grapes grow and the clouds clear and the sunshine come out for you today.
Yes, may they grow without disease. That's the key.
Indeed. We'll talk to you next week, Don.
All right, thank you. Bye-bye.
Music resumes on a Broken Road Radio Monday morning.